Welcome, dear hunters, managers, and enthusiasts. This is Deer University, the podcast of the Mississippi State University Deer Lab. My name is Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris. Bronson and I are professors of wildlife management and co-directors of the MSU Deer Lab. Together, we've researched deer across the United States for more than 40 years. In our podcasts, we explain the why and how of deer management based on science. Whether it's research we've conducted or explaining research done elsewhere, we'll offer you a college course in the science of deer management.
But don't let Steve scare you. This isn't going to be a review of calculus or chemistry. Instead, we take results of research, reduce it to what's important, and explain how you can apply research to management. So join us for this episode of Deer University. Welcome back to Deer University. Today we are going to speak with Dr. Eric Mitchell. This is a continuation of the previous podcast where I visited with Steve Damaris and Chad Dacus, and we spoke about this decade-long research project conducted in Mississippi where we were trying to determine or disentangle the effects of both environment, which in this case really was nutrition, the effects of nutrition versus genetics in deer populations, I guess three deer populations we were looking at in Mississippi. We had a population from our agricultural intense region called the Delta, another region that we call the Hills here in Mississippi. It's kind of in between. And then what we call our low quality region in terms of deer forage production and deer size, called the Lower Coastal Plain of Mississippi. And the person that finished this project up and analyzed all the data and got it published and really did a fantastic job on the analysis was Eric Mitchell. So Eric, you are on the line here. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, where you're from, how you got to Mississippi and working with the MSU Deer Lab, and maybe tell everybody a little bit where you're at now.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks for having me, Bronson. Really excited to be on the podcast today. So I'm originally from Wisconsin, southwestern Wisconsin. There's a lot of big deer in that part of the state. So I grew up deer hunting and really fortunate to have some family property that we could go right out our back door literally and hunt on. So I knew I wanted to be in the wildlife field. Once I graduated high school, I went to the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point, and they have an excellent wildlife program up there, and did my undergraduate work there. And as I was finishing up college, I knew I wanted to go to grad school, and I wanted to work with white-tailed deer, but I was kind of open to whatever came my way. I wasn't trying to be too picky. And lo and behold, a position was announced at Mississippi State University working with Steve Damaris and working with their captive research facility with white-tailed deer. So out on a limb, I went ahead and applied for it and got the position and moved down to Starkville in December of 2009 and stayed there for, it was about 6.5 years. I finished up last March, in March 2016. So went down there originally for my master's. And once I was finishing up my master's, knew I wanted to go on for a PhD and was lucky enough to be offered a position to continue on some of my master's research and finish up this project for my PhD. So it was a great experience down there. It was definitely fun while it lasted, and we're still doing a lot with that information. Currently, I'm up here at South Dakota State University working with Dr. John Jenks, who's another very well-known deer ecologist. And we're still working white-tailed deer, but just this time we're working with them up in the Northern Great Plains. Right now, currently, I'm actually working on an analysis looking at differences in vegetation characteristics at bed sites of fawns. And I'm going to try to link that to survival. I don't know if I'll be able to do that very well, but pretty much just assessing if there's any certain vegetation characteristics that fawns prefer compared to random. So that's kind of what we're doing now. We're looking at other different behavior characteristics for deer, looking at migration strategies, stuff like that. So it's going to be some pretty cool information we're going to get out of this research.
So, Eric, with your fawn study, you're looking at the vegetation which they normally bed in or where they were born, and you're going to link that to survival primarily in terms of predation or predation risk?
So, there's a combination of the bedsite characteristics where they were found. They had these fawns. They had telemetry units on these fawns, so they knew where they were. Some of these fawns, we just have information from where they were born. Obviously, they expired a couple days or, you know, a week or so later. We have a mixture of different mortality events. Some are predated. Some were natural cause. A lot of times we don't think about how weather plays into fawn survival, particularly in spring. You know, in Mississippi, you're thinking about just hot weather. But up here in South Dakota, you know, in June, it's not unreasonable to think that you could have a night where you're getting down to the mid or lower 40s for a low. If you mix that with a rain event, now you have thermal issues, and different vegetative characteristics could potentially influence survival that way too.
I gotcha. You know, that'll be a great follow-up, Eric. When you get some of the data analyzed and you feel comfortable, probably when you're sending it in for publication, that would be a great follow-up. You know, we did Impacts of Predators. Steve and I recorded an episode, and then Marcus and I recorded an episode. And we are big believers in that habitat does matter. So, yes. You know, there's a lot of emphasis on, in mainly down here, we're thinking about coyotes. So there's a lot of emphasis on coyote control. But we also want to put a big emphasis on habitat, you know, managing habitat to improve fawn survival. So it would be great to hear what you're finding up in a different region up in South Dakota. So we'll touch base later on that.
Sounds good.
Well, Eric, you know, when you got to and you were familiar with some of the research to begin with, and you've now had a chance to be a lot more familiar with the research conducted in South Dakota, it turns out that in South Dakota, you have a minimum. There may be more regions, but at least two regions in the state that are similar to Mississippi, in that you have a very an ag dominant, an agriculture dominant system or region, and then you have another area of the state that's not. And from everyone's interpretation, at least, that that is influencing the size of deer. Bigger deer were located in the ag region. Larger antlers are located in the ag region. And the researchers at South Dakota State did something very similar to your PhD research. Why don't you bring everybody up to speed about that experiment and the highlights of what they found?
Sure. Yeah, so this particular study was actually published back in 2009. So we had, in Mississippi, you all have just been working on that current 10-year project for about 4 or 5 years at that point. In South Dakota, it's pretty much split up into what we call up here East River and West River. So you have the Missouri River that pretty much splits the state right down the middle. And eastern South Dakota is primarily ag-dominated. Lots of soybeans, lots of corn. That's where your agricultural production is going to occur. West River is primarily rangeland. But within the West River, you have what's called the Black Hills region. That's primarily forested, rolling hills, just gorgeous country. But it's the same situation what we saw in Mississippi. Really, really big deer are being harvested from the agricultural region, and smaller deer are being harvested from the Black Hills. And the same question always arises, is this genetics or nutrition? So they developed a similar study to what we had, where they brought animals into a captive facility, allowed them to breed, fed them all the same nutrition, and allowed them to grow. And they found very, very similar results, where those second-generation bucks, those F2 bucks from the lower quality soil region, were increasing and approaching the same size as the second-generation bucks from the high-quality region. So again, what they thought they found and what they documented was what we would call a maternal effect, that long-term changes in nutrition can have effects on antler and body size of offspring.
Eric, what was their response in the first generation similar to ours? Was there much improvement with the first group of fawns that were born?
As far as I'm trying to think back with antler size, I think it was a pretty similar response. Body weight, I can't remember exactly what it was. I know first and second generation across the board was similar. I can't remember the exact numbers though.
Okay. But the bottom line is the second generation, just like with your study, had caught up, so to speak, had compensated, and were now a lot larger than the deer from their original region, from the Black Hills region. They were now approaching the ag region in terms of body size and antler size.
Yep.
You know what, Eric, when we were going through all the literature from way back when you were working on your PhD, we found a lot of reference to a German researcher that worked with both red deer and roe deer, who was documenting these types of effects prior to World War II.
Yeah, that was some really interesting research, and particularly thinking about the time that this was being done, pre-World War II. Franz, was it Vogt, or how do you pronounce his last name?
I say Vogt, but we can say whatever we want.
I guess I don't know if anybody's gonna correct us on that. No, it's interesting. He did this research with, like you said, red deer and roe deer, which essentially red deer is a cousin to the elk, very similar, and roe deer is pretty much what our equivalent of a white-tailed deer would be over in Europe, a little bit smaller, but and some other subtle differences, but essentially, very comparable. And what they found, this guy was really ahead of his time thinking about nutrition and genetics, and he thought that these differences in antler size of these animals across Europe were due to differences in nutrition. But again, the same concept, the same idea of genetics and needing genetically superior animals to increase antler and body size was even prevalent back then. So he started comprising and doing these nutrition studies and showing the highest quality nutrition that was compatible for these animals and what they preferred to eat, and started putting all this stuff together and essentially did what we did. And after a few generations, they were producing record book sized animals, and they related that all back to nutrition and not genetics. And at the time, this was all being done, recorded in German. So it kind of, during the wars, kind of got lost. And it wasn't until the late 80s when Valerius Geist, who was a German himself, was actually able to interpret his results and translate it to English, that we started to kind of learn more about some of this other research.
Yeah, I remember reading that for the first time and was just blown away because the gains that occurred. And so, and I don't remember the study design. It was so many years ago when I read it. But basically, the researcher didn't start with just getting trophy class deer. I mean, he got roe deer and red deer that were kind of representative of the areas that he was working, and just had a good sample size, a group of these deer. And started monitoring the change in antler size. But consistent with your stuff, Eric, is that every generation started seeing incremental increases, and it just really got us thinking, about, our little joke we use now, but it's the truth. It's not what you eat, it's what your mother ate, and it's even what your grandmother ate. That can impact the expression of your genetics. And, we were talking about his study. Vogt's study was prior to World War II, and unfortunately, I think during World War II, his study facility, I think, was destroyed, and so that was kind of the end of the experiment. But during World War II, was another example of a natural study that was occurring with human beings. And so I think you remember, Eric, that in the scientific literature, post-World War II was where they started looking at the effects of lack of nutrition on people's offspring, on people's kids, and even grandkids. And I believe, Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, that was really when this concept of epigenetics really started to take hold, is that we had this long-held view or understanding of how genetics worked. And genetics were fixed. Phenotype can vary, but your genetics are fixed. So when mom and dad, when reproduction occurs, and that new genome is produced, there's no changing it. But these researchers started noticing that people that were exposed to grandparents that were exposed to good nutrition or really poor nutrition, that it was still impacting their grandkids. And so that really kind of kicked off. How in the world is that occurring? And so that whole concept of around epigenetics, there are other influences going on. And we certainly think, Eric, that that is what explains what you documented so well with that second generation.
Yeah, we didn't set up this study design to specifically look at an epigenetic effect, but this sure does fall right in line with what we read about epigenetics and the outcomes that we would expect when you start taking into account epigenetics. So we didn't do anything in the lab looking at the genotype and actually getting under a microscope and looking at different changes, but just the actual result from the phenotype from antler and body size and the increases sure fits that mold very, very well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Eric, let's walk everybody through. If they listened to the previous podcast, it may have been a week or two or more when they heard it. So let's kind of step through your findings real quick. Wild does, pregnant does, pregnant females were collected in the wild, free range, and that was logistics. I hate to say a nightmare, but it was intensive, very, very intensive.
Yeah.
To collect all of those does, and all those does then pregnant were brought back to the deer research facility here, and they had their fawns. And once they had their fawns, and once those fawns were weaned, mother was now out of the picture. Mother was no longer part of the research. We were now just looking at the fawns. And when they grow up, you know, Eric, you were here at the end. You were taking measurements. Fawns when they're born, 6 months later, a year later, 2 years later, 3 years later. And so we were able to track, their body weight and antler size over time. But it's really, I can't emphasize this enough, that once that fawn was weaned, let's talk about bucks, and let's talk about bucks when you measured them at 3.5 years of age. All those fawns had the exact same diet. They had the exact same nutrition. So
correct.
We had the different groups separated. So we had like our Delta bucks were in a pen or group of pens, you know, so there was no intermingling, interbreeding. They were confined in different locations, but they ate the exact same food and they could eat all they wanted. But to our shock and amazement, those lower coastal plain deer, those bucks at 3.5, really didn't change. Even though they ate what we would consider, you know, the best possible diet they could eat, they gained a few inches of antler, I think about 5 or so inches of antler, and maybe a pound of body weight compared to the bucks in the wild. And so we were really scratching our head, like, what in the, you know, I was like, there's got to be a mistake here, Eric. did you run the numbers correctly? We need to look at this. This can't be right.
Well, I remember, because that was, you know, we were wrapping up the first generation bucks right as I was finishing up my master's, really. So my master's project was a little bit different, but I was still doing all the analyses for this project as well. And I remember Steve was giving a tour out our deer pens, and we were going through these results, and he kind of looked around and said, you know, I might have to eat some crow here coming up after, depending on what we find with this second generation. So everybody was very interested to see what the second generation was going to do.
And then lo and behold, that's when we started really digging into this whole, you know, concept of epigenetics. And we started all licking our chops, can't wait for the second generation or the F2, you know, generation to see the results. And that's when the magic happened, right?
Yep. Yeah, so when we started looking at the second generation, you know, when we look at the lower coastal plain bucks, they increased their body weights about 35, 40 pounds from their wild counterparts. And their antler size is about 27, 28 inches or so. So, I mean, those are the increases that we were looking for. Those are really dramatic increases in antler and body size.
So, Eric, remind everybody, and I get asked this question all the time, too, and it's just logistics and finances. We talk about, you know, how a buck is mature, you know, physiologically mature at 5 years of age, sometimes 6 years of age. But basically, we've seen time and time again, and other researchers have too across the country, that, you know, mainly about 6.5 years of age is where, you know, is where we see maximum antler growth. But the reason we couldn't carry the study that long is because it would have added at least another 6 or 7 years onto an already 10-year project. So you, Eric, you used the 3.5-year-old body sizes and antler sizes as an indicator, of course, of where they are now and then what they will grow to become. Can you share with people what those bucks would have grown into at maturity?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we pretty much ended this study when these bucks were 3.5 years of age. So if we look at the average first generation lower coastal plain antler score for those bucks is about 95 inches. So it's kind of hard, you know, if you hunt and you know 95 inches on the B and C scale, it's not a huge deer. It's hard to visualize that if you're not familiar with that scoring system, but it's not a bad deer. It's a good looking deer, but it's not what people who, you know, are looking for some of these larger, older age bucks. That's not what they're looking for. But again, this is at 3.5 years of age. And we know from prior research that at 3.5 years of age, a buck's only reached about 75% of his maximum antler size. So he's still got 25% left to grow once he hits that six and a half years of age. So using a normalized growth curve, kind of projecting that what that antler size would be at that age, you know, that first generation buck that's 95 inches at 3.5 years of age is going to be about 122 inches at 5.5 or 6.5 years of age. So I believe the Pope and Young scoring system for harvesting a deer with your bow, trophy record book buck for that system is 125 inches net,
yep.
I think.
Yep, that's right.
So on average, after one generation, you're producing pretty close to a Pope and Young buck. So, I mean, that's pretty big deal just after one generation. But, you know, that's not necessarily what people are looking for all the time, and they want those 150s, 160s. So looking at our second generation bucks, for the lower coastal plain at 3.5 years of age, they average about 116 inches. So again, there's your huge increase from first to second generation. But again, that's at 3.5 years of age. You project that out to 6.5, and now you're looking at, on average, 147 inch deer. So
you
almost
go from
bumping
120s to 140s.
Exactly. So that's a huge difference, and really emphasizes the importance of age. You know, there is no quick fix. You got to let these animals reach maturity. And that's where you're going to make a lot of gains in antler size.
So, Eric, with your presentations in the past, and this is kind of consistent in the literature, too. The terminology is kind of switching the genes on and off. And so this whole what used to be called maternal effects, and there's a lot of different maternal effects, meaning, you know, mother has a big impact on their offspring and, you know, the size or the phenotype, the look, you know, of the offspring. If mom's in bad condition, it can affect the offspring. If mom's in good condition, it can affect the offspring. But this epigenetic effect, we always hear that as flipping them on and off, or turning those genes on and off. And really what that means is, and again, Eric, I may be oversimplifying here, and you're more familiar with the literature, so please correct me if I'm wrong, but what you're saying and what you found here is that those lower coastal plain bucks had, quote, the genes to produce 140 inch antlers at maturity, but the environment or nutrition, as it affected their mother, the doe, did not allow those genes to be expressed. So when those fawns were conceived, you know, we say in utero, you know, after they were conceived and they were still, you know, gestating in the mother's body is conveying information to those little fetuses as they're growing, and basically switching some genes on and off. These genes should be expressed, or these genes should not, or maybe the extent of expression of some genes. But that's what it took. It wasn't just what the buck ate from being weaned as a fawn, growing to 3 years of age. It depended on what the buck's mother ate, and whether she was physiologically in good condition at the time of conception.
No, that's exactly right. You think about it in just really simple terms. It's essentially the mother communicating the environment that she's experiencing with her offspring and saying, hey, we're in a good environment. We've been consistently in a good environment for the past few years. Now it's adaptive to start growing larger antler and body sizes compared to what it was before. It's just Mother Nature's way of allowing these animals to adapt to their environment. And like you guys talked about last time, it's not always advantageous to have large antlers and large body sizes because you have to maintain those large antlers and large body sizes with a lot of nutrition, high quality nutrition. And if you're not in a consistently good environment that's producing high quality nutrition, it's just not going to happen. It's not adapted for you to grow large like that.
That's, you know, when we were saying earlier about Valerius Geist, he also had some other great information with deer, mainly deer species, but other critters as well, but kind of call it the island effect. If you remember, if you were to take, in other words, if you were kind of doing just the opposite, if you wanted three or four generations, if you wanted to see deer get smaller, you would use like this island effect where nutrition can be very, very limited. The quality, you know, of the food, it either may not be that abundant or the quality may not be as good. But the smaller you make your body, the better you can cope with limited food resources. And then just the opposite happens. Their body size is released, so to speak. So after a couple generations, when the mother determines, so to speak, she's not thinking about this consciously, yeah, but her body's feeding back, telling her, hey, there's plenty of food here. There's a lot of food. The quality of the food is good. I can afford to grow bigger. And you know what, Eric? Here's something we talked about. I remember in your PhD orals, you know, this is the biologist part of us, what we think about. Why is it advantageous if there's more food? Why is it advantageous for a deer to get bigger?
Yeah, it's all relative to the next deer. And you think about it from a breeding perspective, if you have a much larger set of antlers and a much bigger body, and you can continually produce that and maintain that, that's going to give you theoretically going to give you an advantage in breeding. And you're just trying to pass on your genes, and you're trying to sire as many offspring as you possibly can in your lifetime. That's the ultimate goal of pretty much any wild animal, is to survive and to breed. So those are the two big things that those animals are trying to do.
Eric, I'm proud of you. You knocked it out of the park.
Had a lot of preparation for that one. Lots of conversations.
I was going to look into rescinding the whole PhD if you didn't get that one right. But yeah, you summarized it perfectly. So if there's a lot of resources, a lot of food resources, and you can afford to grow, for a male, a buck especially, to grow a bigger body, and we know what big of an impact having a big body when two bucks are competing for dominance. And that dominance will then go into breeding. You know, you're going to have more breeding opportunity. So it follows theory perfectly. The bigger you can get within limits, you know, then it goes the other way. If you get too big, now the environment won't support that body size. So, you know, Mother Nature, there's a balancing point, kind of a seesaw, you know, that goes back and forth. The environment kind of informs the body, what's the most beneficial, you know, body size, and that's kind of how the animals respond.
I was just gonna say, if we go back to that the island comment that you made just a couple minutes ago, you know, a study done in Canada on Anticosti Island kind of showed that exact thing, where they had an island of white-tailed deer, and they'd been there for 20 or 30 years, and they basically browsed themselves out of house and home, and what they saw over time is just continually getting smaller and smaller. These animals, the body weights were just decreasing and decreasing because there's no nutrition. So it works in both ways. You can increase antler and body size, or you can decrease it, just depending upon the quality of nutrition that's available.
Hey, Eric, another thing that we discussed when you were here that we all thought was really cool was what we called your growth priority analysis. And that's just a kind of a fancy way of saying, so now when a new generation of deer, bucks in this case, so now when they have more nutrition, what do they allocate that nutrition to? So what body feature first responds and gets bigger, and what's the last thing to respond? Do you remember us talking about that?
Yeah. So when we always emphasize the antler score and the body weights when we're talking about this research, but we did take several other measurements from different characteristics of these deer as well. So in addition to the estimated BNC score for overall antler size, we also weighed the antler. So we had an antler mass or antler weight. And then we had the body mass or body weight, and then we took measurements of the skeleton too. So we took total body length and hind foot length to represent the skeleton. And when we started looking at the response of these different characteristics, we saw a very distinct what we call the growth prioritization for these metrics. So if you improve nutrition, the first metric you can expect to respond is actually going to be antler mass. I think that was about a 20% increase from first to second generation. That responded the quickest and the most. Then that was followed by overall antler score, followed by body weights, and then last was the skeletal characteristics. So you start thinking about these different metrics and their ability to respond and improve nutrition, and it fits pretty well within deer ecology and breeding ecology in particular. You know, antlers are going to be an annual investment. They're going to shed those antlers. Each deer is going to shed his antlers every year, and if there's high-quality nutrition available in the next year, they can grow a little bit larger set of antlers, but they're only an annual investment compared to body weight, which you have to continually carry around throughout your life. So it makes sense that from that standpoint, your antler characteristics are responding first. But even within that, antler mass particularly, when you think about how deer fight to gain access to does, it's a pushing match. And you need a heavy, massive set of antlers to really be able to withstand that force of a fight once those bucks lock antlers. So you can't necessarily having larger antlers isn't going to do you any good if they continually break. So you invest first in that antler mass and then antler size. The characteristics that respond the least, the skeletal metrics, again, that's what we would call a highly canalized trait. Canalized is just a fancy word for saying that things are going to stay the same regardless of the environment. And that held true. We only saw like a 2 or 3% increase in hind foot length and total body length. So your skeleton is going to form pretty well regardless of the environment that you're experiencing. And that's going to set the base for the amount of weight that you can put on your body and then everything else.
Yeah, it's if you make a mistake too, that's hard to correct for. If you have a skeletal size, you know, if there's a mismatch with your antlers, well, if you just make it through that year, you can grow another set of antlers the next year. But man, when that skeletal size is set, you're stuck with that the rest of your life. So, yeah, that did not have near the sensitivity or flexibility, you know, that we saw with antlers, and then with body weight also. Well, Eric, you have validated your PhD once again.
It's good to know. Good to have these conversations from time to time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Eric, we always wrap up your presentations with the management implications. And so let's do the same here. The management implications are on so many levels. You know, you can't do anything about genetics. In a free-ranging environment, which is what most people are hunting in, you're not going to do anything with changing at a population scale the genetics. The wonderful news is that you can most definitely change phenotype. You can increase body size. You can increase antler size of the average, you know, for the population by improving nutrition. But it's going to take a while. So, Eric, what do you think minimally in the places you've been here and the places you are now in South Dakota, what do you think? You're thinking this is going to take at least 5 years and up to 10 years to really see that manifested?
Yeah, I think you're talking about 5 to 10 years to really see these results. I mean, if you increase and improve the nutritional quality within a given year, you know, that following year, you might see some individuals respond to that improved nutrition. But when we're talking about population level scales, that's going to take 5 to 10 years at least to see some of these effects.
What, you know, in the South, our biggest tools for improving nutrition, number one, habitat management. Of course, that's most often in the South, we're dealing with forest. And, you know, typically we always say that habitat management in the South is always going to involve forest management. So we're going to be managing our forests. We want to get more sunlight on the ground. We want to provide more deer food. And then we want to maintain that, you know, with prescribed burning. That's on the habitat management side. That's typically what we're striving to do, that type of program. The other component of that, of course, is supplementing with food plots. And so we can really boost the nutrition at the times of year that are really, really important to deer, which is pretty much all the time, but especially with cool season food plots. Just thinking about when a doe is conceiving, they're going to be conceiving in the fall or winter, depending on where you're at. So we want that doe to be in great condition that time of year. And then when those fawns are being developed during gestation in the spring and on into the summer in the south, we want to make sure we have adequate nutrition and good nutrition, and food plots can really play a huge role in that department. What about in South Dakota? What are the most common tools you see up there that deer managers are going to use to improve nutrition?
Sure. Well, it's obviously pretty different up here during a winter compared to in Mississippi. There's really nothing for animals to eat outside of, you know, residual waste grain or some woody browse that you have in these shelter belts. So one of the things, you know, kind of going back to you mentioned prescribed burning, I think that's a good tool to use to improve nutritional quality in the spring. But the wintertime, one of the biggest things I think that we can do here is just improve the quality of cover. And try to reduce the severity of the effect of winter on these animals. You know, a deer's diet up here is going to switch pretty much to woody browse because there's nothing else that they really have to eat outside of waste grain from ag fields. So those shelter belts are really, really important in providing that as well. So a lot of times you'll see animals herding up in these shelter belts because it's providing cover, it's providing food. So having that browsy vegetation around is really important.
Eric, define for everybody, what's a shelter belt?
Sure. A shelter belt is basically a couple of rows of trees in between ag fields that reduces wind erosion is essentially what it's doing. So up here you have, it's a highly fragmented landscape, lots of agriculture with these shelter belts or these tree rows or shrubs that are being planted in between to help reduce that wind erosion when after, you know, farmers disc up and till their fields, that soil staying put or trying to stay put at least.
Can you manage the shelter belts in terms of with tree harvesting or thinning or things like that to really promote a lot of more vegetation on the ground?
Not really. I mean, these are pretty thin shelter belts. You're not thinking of a stereotypical, I guess, forest type like what you would have in Mississippi. These are pretty long and narrow shelter belts that get a lot of sunlight from each side.
Okay.
Anyway, so pretty much just having a shelter belt there is just a really good start.
So during the growing season, the warm season, so depending on where you're at in South Dakota, in the Midwest, et cetera, I mean, there's going to be a lot of area in the Midwest is going to have agriculture, and soybeans and corn, you know, are pretty much always going to be a big component of that. What are some popular food plot species? Do people even plant warm season food plots in South Dakota?
You know, they do, but there's not, at least from my experience here talking to landowners, it's not as emphasized as it is in Mississippi because there is so much agriculture. Every talk I give, that's still going to be a question. What's the best food plot that I can plant? And, you know, in Mississippi, that would generally be something like soybeans, something that's not necessarily prevalent across the landscape outside of obviously the Delta region. But here you have corn, you have beans, you have winter wheat, you know, the cereal grains that are being planted as cover crops. So coming up with different types of food plots to plant is a little bit different. I generally just tell people try to plant something that's different than what's being planted around you. You know, try to get something a little bit more, has a little bit more variety than the corn and beans that's being put in from an agricultural production standpoint.
I see. Well, Eric, thank you so much for visiting today. It was good to talk to you, of course. And, really cool to hear about the research you're doing in South Dakota, and we will definitely touch base with you again in the upcoming months when you get more data collected and analyzed. That's going to be really interesting to see the impact of vegetation characteristics on fawn survival.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get that stuff analyzed and submitted for publication here pretty soon.
Okay, my man. It was great talking to you, Eric.
Great talking to you, Bronson. Good catching up.
Howdy everyone, we are back in the Deer Lab, and we wanted to provide an opportunity to give all the listeners an overview of this really monumental, or we think monumental, research that was conducted over the past decade. So we devoted two podcasts to this information, and we want to make sure that everyone has a good summary understanding of what we accomplished, and we also want to wrap up with some action items. So we want to make sure everybody understands what we did and has the take-home message, as well as things to do. So Steve, if you don't mind, first summarize what you think are the biggest points that people need to know, understand, and act upon with this research.
Okay, we had two main findings, Bronson. One is that if you're in a region with smaller bodied deer and you think you have a genetics problem, you probably don't. You probably have a nutrition problem, a habitat quality problem, and that like the deer that we brought in from the lower coastal plain, our region of the state with the lowest quality soils and the overall lowest quality habitat and land use, like the deer that we brought in from our middle quality region that were well below the body and antler size of our better quality region, those animals weren't smaller because they had a genetic limitation. They were smaller because of generation after generation after generation of eating lower quality foods than deer in the better quality regions. So if you give them food, they can grow larger, but it takes time. Second major point was our gold standard, the Delta region, also increased body and antler size over the process of two generations eating better quality food. So even where we thought we had our best stuff on the ground, it's not better. It's not as good as it could be.
It could still be better.
It could be better. So if you think you've got the best stuff out there, you probably don't.
You know, Steve, I thought of this as well. I want to make sure people understand, because we titled this and framed this environment versus genetics with this project, and nutrition versus genetics with this project. We're not saying that genetics aren't important, but at a scale like this with a population, genetics really aren't that important. You know, what you and I say a lot is genetics will obviously influence an individual. Individuals are programmed to be a certain size, and then nutrition allows them to fulfill that. But at a population scale, what we have seen with this project is that a population is not limited by genetics. They're limited by nutrition.
Absolutely.
Well, Marcus, we want to give people the opportunity to really drive home what some action items are. And so, you being our habitat specialist, why don't you give people a sense of, if they could get out in the woods this summer, this fall, this coming spring, what things that they need to look for? What things can they do to improve nutrition?
All right, Bronson. I think this is pretty exciting for a lot of reasons. One, I've been around the southeast in a lot of poor areas, and I've been in some that have been managed really well and seen some very impressive deer in those areas. And it's pretty exciting to think about this project, because you basically demonstrated that genetics are not the limitation. And even more exciting to me, at least, as a scientist, is that it's an epigenetic thing. So in other words, they have the gene there, and they have to flip the light switch on. Mm-hmm. So they flip that gene on, and it takes a couple of generations. Well, I thought that was pretty interesting, because when you think about what you need to do in terms of habitat, it's also flipping the light switch on. Most of the time, people have a closed canopy forest if it's managed poorly, and light is limiting the understory. So you want a nice developed understory of forbs and browse in the reach of deer, and without sunlight you can't do that. So you need to flip that light switch on. The other thing that could be really important is some sort of soil disturbance. So fire in your forest stands, fire or disking in open fields where sunlight is not a problem. Those could be pretty important. And another thing that I want to remind the audience is mineral stumps. They still work in poor soils. And that could be a really important management tool for you, especially if you're in one of these poor soil regions. You get a lot more bang out of your buck for some of these practices, and whether you're cutting down trees or burning or some combination thereof, you could provide really high quality nutrition over a long time period for your deer, even if you're in really poor soil.
So managing habitat, managing nutrition, and of course, you can supplement with food plots.
Absolutely.
We always want to emphasize... Yeah,
they're definitely a great supplement.
And that's the term we like to use, mm-hmm. supplement. We supplement with food plots, but you got to have the foundation of habitat Absolutely. There as well. And, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day, and neither is going to be this intergenerational effect of a deer population. That's not going to be a diet pill response. It's going to take years and years, but knowledge is power. And so now hopefully the listeners have the knowledge and the power to change their deer population.
I think I'd like to just kind of sum up what Marcus just said. I really like that. We've been talking figuratively about turning on the genetic switches. And Marcus just, you know, the light switch of light on the ground. That's a great analogy, mm-hmm. and it really tells the story. Get light on the ground with that switch, and you'll turn on your genetic switches.
Turn on the genetic switches, the epigenetics.
You know, when you walk into your bedroom, you have to turn that light switch on before you can go and turn the light switch on in the bathroom, right?
That's right.
So it's the same thing with habitat. You may implement practices, and it may take a little bit of time for you to improve the habitat quality, and then it's going to take time on top of that for your deer to turn on their switch and start responding to improved habitat with quality that you can see on the deer.
That sounds like a good topic to another podcast for Marcus to talk about.
Yeah.
Turning on the light switch in the forest canopy or underneath the forest canopy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and really, and talk more about this whole topic that we've talked about before about just the quality of the habitat and how you can get more of a response mm-hmm. in the lower quality habitat.
Yeah.
That's just really exciting, yeah. And I think it gives people that are, you know, maybe feel like after the last couple of podcasts that, maybe I'm not stuck with mm-hmm. where I hunt deer and manage deer. And maybe we can do better mm-hmm. and give them hope. And more than hope, give them ways to do it.
Absolutely.
Well, guys, thanks a bunch. This ends our two-part series on nutrition versus genetics. And we hope you all at home will turn in next time to Deer University. We're glad you joined us today and hope you learned something valuable about deer management. If you have questions about this podcast or a question about a topic we haven't discussed, please log on to msudeerlab.com, click on the Deer University tab, and send us your questions. We'll get to them as soon as possible. In closing, we want to thank our employers, the Mississippi State University Extension Service, and the Forest and Wildlife Research Center. We also want to thank the St. John and Dudley Hutchinson families for their endowments that support deer research and education.